Okay, we are in Leviticus. I'd like to ask everybody to open to Leviticus, but I'm going to have a rather lengthy introduction to the material this evening, so we'll actually be looking into the 11th chapter until quite a ways into the class itself. It has been, because of the snow and a record-breaking winter, now 3 weeks actually since the last time we've had this class. The last two are canceled, and so we're kind of divorced, I guess, you know, from the material here a little bit. But if you look at the screen here with our 10th class tonight, I've shown you an outline of Leviticus a couple of times in preceding classes. And it's pretty easy, actually, to outline this book. The first seven chapters elaborate upon the five principal sacrifices that the Levitical priesthood will be involved in. The book, of course, is named after Levi and has to do with the Levitical priesthood. And so it is an entire book that is about the particular sacrificial system and related responsibilities of those priests. So it starts off with the five principal sacrifices, and we covered that quite a ways back. Then, last time we met, we looked at chapters 8, 9, and 10. Those chapters, rather than being a list of laws and this should be done and this should not be done, is an actual narrative. So we get a historical record there. And of course, it ends, most disturbingly in chapter 10, with the very first time, apparently, that these sacrifices are offered on the very day that these priests had been cleansed. The two sons, Nadab and Abihu, of Aaron, the high priest, introduced something that God had not commanded. They will pay for this with their lives, and so there is a very stark warning that God presents to these priests on the very first day. I intend to have things done my way. I will not accept in your worship and in these sacrifices and any of your activities before me as my priests, you deciding that you want to introduce something that may seem really fine and good to you, but which I haven't asked for. So it does not require, it's one of the great lessons in your Bible, that God list all the things that he forbids. This would be a list bigger than the planet itself, I suppose. But instead, we learn there in chapter 10, very dramatically, God only has to tell us what he does want. And then that's all we're authorized to do. We go and add something to that that he has not commanded us to do, even if he has not actually expressly forbidden the thing. The fact that he hasn't forbidden it does not mean that we can go ahead and just invent it. So Nadab and Abihu have served a wonderful purpose, I think, throughout the ages in teaching all of us by way of their death. There's an example for you. God intends to have things done the way he says they should be done and without our input. But tonight is when, eventually after this lengthy introduction, we're going to really get into what is the heart of this entire book. So, chapters 11 through 15 distinguish between what is clean and what is unclean. It is particularly introductory information with regard to that concept that I'd like to set before you before we actually get into the lists themselves of what God designates as clean or unclean. So we'll be coming back to that in just a minute. For reasons that I can't discern and I don't know anybody can, it's kind of odd that we have one chapter then that tells us about the Day of Atonement, which would seem to me, if I were organizing the book, you know, to put up here with these laws of sacrifices, it seems more natural to me. But, you know, for whatever reason, and I don't know what that reason is, we have this sort of interlude, I guess. We get one chapter about the Day of Atonement, and then effectively, to the end of the book, chapter 17 through 26, we're right back to distinguishing what's clean and unclean. Though I've used this title, You Shall Be Holy, For I Am Holy, because in both cases, what it's about is God separating his people. What is holy is that which is set apart for a particular purpose or designated as being unique and different somehow from all other similar things. And so the great bulk of this book, chapters 11 through 15 and chapters 17 through 26, are on that topic. And we have these other chapters that we've been talking about. But I want to get to some introductory thoughts because There's been a thing percolating, I guess, in my mind now for years. And I've been aware of a couple of passages that I want to show you here this evening and hopefully kind of clarify in some broad outline something about the character of God, the nature of God, that I believe will really help us to understand some of these rules in chapters 11 through 15 and 17 through 26, which are eye-crossingly weird to us much of the time. You look at it, and it just seems cuckoo, and you wonder, why? What's the point? And so a lot of questions arise, and it has proven these chapters, 11 through 15 and 17 through 26, to give a lot of fodder to the unbeliever. The skeptics are often attacking the Bible because they'll go in and they'll pick some obscure law that maybe is only one verse. And then they'll make all kinds of hay out of how silly it is, you know, and anybody with half a brain could see that's ridiculous. And we'll talk about those when we get there. But I'm hoping tonight that if we'll take a little bit of time for background in general, it will give us a foundation as to why God distinguished anything as clean or unclean. And then we'll also, hopefully, you know, have a clearer picture. It's not going to be so mysterious as to why he made particular designations in certain characteristics. So what I'm trying to do, and I only picked this picture here because thinking about Jesus talking about building on the rock, you know, rather than on the sand, this seemed to me like a photograph, you know, built on a very solid foundation, you know, of a rock. It's a good hefty building, you know, a lot of stone and everything. So let's think about some foundational thoughts for several slides and therefore several verses that we can establish as a foundation for really the rest of our whole study in the book of Leviticus. And this perhaps is chief among them. In 1 John chapter 1 and verse 5, there's this very short sentence which we all of us remember. It's notable. It's easy to remember. It's very fundamental, but it's very profound. It covers a lot of bases. And I think in this case, it really undergirds everything in the book of Leviticus and elsewhere. Deuteronomy we'll be studying after Leviticus. In 1 John 1 verse 5, God is what? He is light. And as if that isn't clear enough, stark, you know, and prominent enough, then we have the little addendum at the rest. After the three words, God is light, he adds, and in him, brethren, how much darkness is there? Well, there's none at all. In him, there is no darkness at all. Now, for just a moment, though, I'd like for us to think about that statement. We are just given this insight into God's character, into his nature. This is about as fundamental as you can hope to get about God's composition, you know, the way he feels and thinks about things. So, he is light, and there is no darkness in him at all. So, for instance, I'm not even going to put the next verse up, but let me ask, can God tell a lie? No, God can't tell a lie. Why? Because the lie would be of darkness, and in God there isn't any of that. God cannot tell a lie because God is light and there is no darkness in him. So now what I'd like for us to think about, though, is this. Would God ever legislate that a thing which is inherently evil would be okay? I don't think so. And we're going to look at a couple of verses in Leviticus and Deuteronomy that might help us, you know, to flesh this idea out. If God is going to permit or allow something or command something to be done, as a God who is all light and no darkness whatsoever, I'm of the opinion, at least, that he is never going to command or permit or allow a thing that is inherently evil. If the thing's nature is a contradiction somehow to God's light and exclusion of darkness, I think God would have a hard time then saying, go ahead, I'll let you do this evil deed. Now, conversely, does God have the right to say, I'm going to give you a law that involves things that are not inherently evil or good? They just are. Well, it's not a violation of his character if he says, you may only eat 3 chocolate chip cookies in a day. Now, he never did that, of course, but I'm just giving you an illustration. Parents do this all the time. We make all kinds of laws with our children. But we make laws sometimes that are not the forbidding of something that's inherently evil. I'm pretty sure that you could eat a 4th chocolate chip cookie and not be breaking some cosmic law. Okay? So do you see what I'm trying to say there? And we'll add some more to this. I don't believe God's ever going to permit a thing that is inherently evil. But I want to allow that God may forbid or require certain things which aren't necessarily inherently righteous either. Okay, Bob, what you got?
Don't you have to qualify that and say only in his kingdom or in the church or in the Jews? Because in the world, people are doing things that are inherently evil all the time, and God allows them to, and God allows a person to have a hardened heart.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I'm not saying he would take away free will and not allow you or permit you to commit a sin. I'm saying he wouldn't endorse that sin and say it's okay for you to commit it. Yeah, that's my fault. I needed to clarify that, and I'm so glad you asked. You know what I'm getting at is I don't think there are certain times where God would teach that murder is okay. Now, we know he condones capital punishment. So is killing inherently evil? If killing a human being is inherently evil, then I think you could never do it under any circumstances. Killing a human being is not inherently evil. Is our taking vengeance inherently evil? Yeah, vengeance is his. We did that on Sunday night. Is murder inherently evil? Yes, it is. God never allows or condones murder. But capital punishment after a proper trial and executed in the manner God stipulated is the killing of a human being, but is it perfectly in concert with God's character? Yes. And has not God killed quite a few people? He has. Was it a sin? No, it wasn't. I'm so glad you asked, because that's very fundamentally important. I'm saying he would not legislate an inherently evil thing to be permissible. He's always going to legislate against it. But he does allow you free will. You can commit those sins. He designates what they are. If you commit them, you know, then one day there'll be a judgment. So let me add to that. Maybe it'll help clarify as well. Here's a passage right out of Leviticus. So if this text is too small, you can turn to Leviticus 20 and have a look at it. And this is one of those verses that, as I say, has been kind of rattling around in my Bible studies and in my mind now for years and years. I've been just kind of wrestling with these principles that I'm laying out this evening. So let's look at Leviticus chapter 20 in verses 25 through 26. Two verses, 25 and 26, Leviticus 20. God says, you are to make a distinction between the clean animal and the unclean animal. Now first, let me just ask, did he say the immoral animal and the moral animal? He didn't use that term at all. He said some of these animals are going to be clean and some are going to be unclean. Did God create these animals? Sure. Is he going to allow these animals to run freely on the earth? Yes. So the animals are not inherently evil, but he is now saying in this book that for these Jews under this religion that Moses is receiving on Sinai, we are now, they hadn't had this before, although, yes, in Genesis, there were some designated, but we don't know how, we're not told how. But now we're getting a written law for these Jews. You Jews, not the Gentiles, this doesn't apply to Gentiles. So were the Gentiles going to be able to eat these unclean animals? Sure, and they did. But for the Jews, they can't. So was God saying, now look, these animals are inherently evil. But I'm going to let the Gentiles eat them, and I'm not going to let you Jews eat them because they're evil. No, they're just animals. But God is deciding that for the Jews, there's this new law, and he's going to leave the Gentiles perfectly free to eat these animals, but not the Jews. So again, you are to make a distinction between the clean animal and the unclean, and between the unclean bird and the clean. You shall not make yourselves detestable by animal or bird or anything that creeps on the ground, which, here's another important part, that's why I say these things were just kind of, you know, rattling around in my head, which I have separated for you as unclean. Did he separate them for the Gentiles as unclean? No, this is unique to the Jews now. So here are just the animals. To whom alone will they be clean or unclean? To the Jews. I've separated them starting now for you as unclean. Thus, you are to be holy to me. For I, the Lord, am holy, and I have set you apart from the peoples to be mine. Now, brethren, I think this is just a tremendously important passage now. The longer I've thought about it, you know, things are sharpening in my mind right here. But particularly at the bottom, the Lord is holy, separated, distinct, different, okay? I have set you apart from peoples, or word for Gentiles, to be mine. I have set you apart. So here, everybody was doing these things. But now, you know, in Abraham, and 400 years later with Moses, I'm taking you people, and I'm going to pull you off out to the side now. You're going to have different rules and regulations than they do. You're going to have a written code of laws. And these laws will set you apart from everybody else. So let's just remember that, and then look for a moment at the next one, which is Deuteronomy chapter 26, verses 18 and 19. Now, bear in mind that we're only 1 year out of Egypt when Leviticus is written. And you know, a little over a year, I guess. But we're just out of Egypt. In Deuteronomy, when that book's written, how long have they been out of Egypt? 40 years. So we have second law, Deuteronomy is what that word means. Moses is going to rehearse all of this again. It's 40 years later. He says, the Lord has today declared you to be his people, a treasured possession, as he promised you, and that you should keep all his commandments, and that he will set you high above all nations which he has made. Did God make all the nations? Sure. Does God love all the nations? Would God save all the nations? Could the nations be saved in their ignorance? Sure they could. In Acts, we have the times of ignorance. God overlooked. Chapter 17, I guess it is. So I'm setting you high above all the other nations. He still loves those nations. He still made those nations. They're two different sets of rules. And these Gentiles don't have the Jewish rules. But there will still be Gentiles that are going to be in heaven and that live during the time of Moses' law because they didn't have to keep Moses' law. I've set you high above all nations which he has made for praise, for fame, and for honor. I'm pulling you apart. So you will have some degree of praise, fame, and honor that these others don't. And that you shall be a consecrated people to the Lord your God as he has spoken. They're very similar to Leviticus 20. And what is he saying? I made all peoples, I love all peoples, I'm going to save all peoples, but there's going to be two sets of rules now. And you Jews, you're being called off to be holy. I'm setting you above these other people, and I'm designating certain things as clean and unclean for you that I'm not going to designate as clean or unclean for everybody else. I thought that was supposed to change, but I don't think it did. So why isn't it changing? Why would a slide, Ted, just refuse to advance? Go to your room. I really need these slides. What am I going to do with this? Oh, here we go. Why did it, all of a sudden, it just took off? It might have done too. Okay, here we go. All right, so another rock picture. We're building on, you know, foundation stones. But remember, so much later, here's Jesus in Mark 7:15. There is nothing outside the man which can defile him if it goes into him. But the things which proceed out of the man are what defile the man. Now, what law is Jesus under at this time? It's under Moses' law, Mark 7, we're only halfway through the gospel. There's nothing, he tells the Jews, while he's under the law, which can defile a man if it goes into him, but the things which proceed out of the man are what defile. Well, what was Leviticus all about then? Starting with chapter 11 on all these things you can eat or not eat. How can Jesus be saying this? And then, in addition, same chapter, Mark 7, verses 18 and 19, he continues, whatever goes into the man from outside cannot defile him, because it does not go into his heart, but into his stomach, and is eliminated. Thus, he declared all foods clean. Now, there's two ways to understand what happened right there, and this is a big part of what I say, and I had these disconnects, and I was just struggling trying to understand what's going on here. You know, we're a year or two before Christ is going to die on the cross. We don't have Christianity yet. If any of the Jews looked at this and said, oh, I'm so glad, I'm going to start eating pigs now, what would happen to them? What law are they under? Would they be committing a sin in defiling themselves, since they were forbidden to eat these foods? Were they not still forbidden to eat these foods? Sure they were. Not till the kingdom, that we call Christianity gets established. So I'm struggling. What is he doing? He's in Matthew 5, he says, don't think I came to annul the law. I came to fulfill it. And then a year before he dies, he says, okay, everybody, you can eat whatever you want. There's no more laws. I've just decided to eliminate all the dietary laws. Is that what he did here? I'm thinking not. Go ahead, Carol.
If he says all food is clean, one of the things that the Jews did was they looked down on the Gentiles because they weren't set apart. They didn't keep the law. And he's talking about the fact that the food's clean, but you have a law restriction. So the two are harmonized because of the way they treated the Jews like dogs for not.
Okay, I think Carol's getting right to the heart of the thing. Is any animal inherently evil if you eat it? Not inherently. If it was inherently evil, it'd be contrary to God's character. He couldn't allow it for the Gentiles or anybody else ever. Okay, so what I'm thinking is very closely akin to what Carol just said. What he's saying is, when the Gentiles were eating what I designated for you Jews to be unclean, they were not committing a sin. They were not being defiled. He declared these foods to be clean, not in the sense that he says, hey everybody, I am obliterating Moses' law. From now on, you can eat bacon. Go for it. And the next morning, you should have heard, you know, the crackling and smell the aroma of all the bacon that was just being cooked throughout Israel a year before Jesus dies or raises from the dead. No, I don't think so. I think what he's saying is, at their root, at their nature, foods don't defile you. But if you're a Jew and God has said, I'm going to set you apart for 1,500 years now with Moses' law from the Gentiles, for them for that length of time, could they eat those foods? No, it would be the fourth cookie. You see what I mean? Not inherently evil, but off limits for you guys during this period of time. Now, let me add to this, and then we'll start looking, you know, at the nature here. In my searches here, I fell across a guy named Professor P.B. Hutt, who wrote an article in the winter of 1994 that's entitled Jewish Dietary Laws and Their Foundation. This is Leviticus 11, Dietary Laws. So it's Harvard University that he was writing for. And so I don't know the man. I don't know his background. You know, I don't know if he's an atheist. I have no idea anything about the guy. But what I was doing is I was just looking for articles to try and help myself and through my teaching, you know, for you, to understand why God had dietary laws at all. Because after all, when Christ now does die on the cross, raises from the dead, 40 days proving it to everybody, ascends into heaven, and 10 days later, the Holy Spirit descends on the apostles, we have Christianity full-blown. There's no more Jew or Gentile. The kingdom is open to everybody. And what about all the Jewish dietary laws? As a Christian, can you eat bacon in the morning? Well, sure you can. We know you can. Because it wasn't inherently evil ever. It was just off limits for the Jews. But is there now Jew or Gentile? No. But people have wrestled for the longest time with the foundation for dietary laws. Why did God, you know, do this? So I picked three out of, I think there were five that he had suggested. But, you know, just to give you an outline, and he uses his words instead of mine, but suggested rationales for the Jewish dietary laws, which is chapter 11 we're coming to in just a minute. Here are the top ones that people have proposed through the years. Number one, and it's been very, very popular in every church, every religion that I know, and in fact, you may know lots of saints among us who would say that it's because of hygiene and safety. So here's his quote to explain that. The reason why God gave the Jews in Leviticus 11 the dietary laws is, quote, "The dietary laws are most often thought of as health measures dictated by the primitive hygienic conditions of the ancient world. According to this theory, Moses, by anticipation of the findings of modern science, was history's greatest public health administrator." So, I love that quote. I thought he did a good job of that one. So, you know, but do you understand what he's saying? How many of you have ever read a very famous book by a guy named Macmillan? He only gave his initials, S.I. Macmillan. A very, very famous book. It goes back to the 50s, I think. It's called None of These Diseases. Have you ever read None of These Diseases? Very popular book. I've loved the book. I've recommended the book. I heartily endorse the book. In much of my early teaching, it was this argument. What it says is, from a different context, but what, you know, it's a quote, "Put none of these diseases upon you, and I put upon the Egyptians." He's taking them out of Egyptian captivity. But the theory was, God knew that pork is unhealthy and will kill you early. God knew that, you know, chewing the cud and split hoof and all of that. God knew what modern science would not learn for centuries. That these foods were inherently not evil, but they were inherently unhealthy. So, God demonstrates his omniscience by decreeing before modern science could even figure it out what you should eat and what you should not eat, so that you will live longer and be healthier. Now that's, as he said, is the most often answer for why God set up the dietary laws. Now here's the problem with that, though. To answer this, and again, I'm using not his words now, but his ideas. Number one, well then, why aren't the poisonous plants likewise forbidden? If these animals are effectively poisonous to us, they're going to shorten our lives, why aren't there any poisonous plants that are put on the list? Is God just, you know, going to let people die from those plants? He's not much of a public health administrator if he isn't going to deal with, you know, plant food as well as animal food. Number two, besides, it's not yet been proven that all of the prohibited animals are actually dangerous. You know, modern science to this day has not designated that all those animals are necessarily bad foodstuffs. Number three, some clean animals are equally dangerous. Sheep and other animals carry these tapeworms. They too can create major problems for you. So now that modern science has discovered that other animals are equally dangerous as the ones that were on the forbidden list, why didn't our first health administrator put them on the list? Well, you can't answer that question, I don't think. Number four, well, why not just tell them how to cook them so that'd be the end of the matter? Instead, he says they're clean or they're unclean because they're unsafe is the theory. Well, why didn't you just say, well, you know, they're unsafe, so I can make them safe if you just cook them like this and you won't have a problem, you need to eat them all. Why didn't you do that? Number five, this is the one that's the most important, I think. Well, then why does the New Testament later allow you to eat all these unclean animals? Stick your nose out on a spring day in Eugene in the morning and there'll be bacon frying somewhere. You can hear, you know, and there's no sin involved. So you see, there's at least five major problems with this theory that what we have in the dietary laws is God's omniscient knowledge of what foods are better or worse to eat. That plane just won't fly, okay? It's just not going to work. Now, here's the second one that is also very popular, but not as popular. Suggested rationale for the Jewish dietary laws is symbolism. And I wanted you to see this one because it crops up in so many other areas of our Bible studies with denominational friends. So here's quote, actual quotation now. The dietary laws were set up, they are symbolic of proper conduct. And obeying the laws conditioned man to act in that manner. Philo explained that permissible domesticated animals must be ruminants, which means what? Chews the cud, by stating that chewing the cud symbolizes the effective learning process of repetition and memorization. Well, why are you laughing? That's a perfectly reasonable... Philo is a very famous guy. And you laugh at him? You think you are as great a philosopher as Philo? But see, you laugh, you snicker, because it's self-evident. So here's the answer. The answer to that is, and again, the quote from this author, the modus operandi of the symbolic approach seems to be largely dependent on the interpreter's imagination. Unless greater discipline can be introduced into symbolist interpretation, it'll always be more liable to represent the whims of the commentator than the purpose of the law. So where would you go in your Bible to figure out that the dietary laws regarding ruminants were intended to be understood as symbolic of repetition so you learn things better? What verse is going to tell you that? How dare you argue with Philo? Well, I'd argue with Philo too. Why? Because it's dumb. That's all you need to know. It just, you know, that won't fly either. I used that illustration already. That dog won't run. Okay? She's not going to work. It's just entirely dependent upon imagination. Now, here's the last one I wanted to deal with, and then we'll go look at the chapter. The suggested rationales for the Jewish dietary laws, social association. I wish he'd called it social separation. You'll see why in a minute. But it's the same idea. Here's the quote. The laws, dietary laws, all laws, clean, unclean, reminded Israel that she had been chosen to be holy in an unclean world. Since the dietary restrictions prevented Israel from eating with her Gentile neighbors, the Jews were essentially placed in social isolation. Dietary laws prevented Jews from hiding their Judaism. Circumcision was a private matter, but the food laws made one's Jewish faith a what? A public affair. Now, again, I'll freely tell you that's speculation. But I think it's the only speculation that harmonizes with Leviticus 20. The fact that the foods are not inherently evil, that God would not allow the Gentiles to eat or do something that was inherently evil. And so these laws, I think their purpose was to keep the Jews separated And also, remember we studied light to the world passage not too long ago. The Jews were said in the Old Testament that they were going to be the light of the world. They were to stand out. This, I think, is why we have the dietary laws. And then why, guess what? I put up here, it needs no answer. But then why you can do away with those laws? Come Christianity, can we do away with these laws? Sure, and why not? Because before, the whole point was to keep the Jews separated from everybody else. But now Christianity is open to what?
Everyone.
Is everybody. So the dietary laws aren't going to matter anymore. Were they hygienic or about, you know, bad food, they would have stayed in place. But they don't.
And God did just that with Peter in Acts chapter 11.
I'm sorry, kid, I don't have my hearing aids.
God did just that in Acts chapter 11.
Okay.
Where Peter didn't want to eat the unclean foods, but God said, don't call anything unclean that I've called clean.
Arise, Peter, kill and eat. Not so, Lord, I've never. Well, cut that out. If I tell you you can't, you know, then you can. But it wasn't God deciding that these evil animals are suddenly pure and upright, you know, and somehow morally correct. It was just him saying that was, and I'm always hesitate whenever I talk to people. I've tested this with a lot of people. I'm always afraid to use this word, but I think it is the best word. God arbitrarily decided what was going to be clean and unclean for the Jews. What do I mean when I say arbitrarily? A sovereign God says, I'm going to have a separate people, and those separate people are going to be under certain laws. And those laws are not delineating the difference between a moral crime, you know, a sin in that sense, and what is not a sin. Many of these laws are going to come only for the Jews and leave with Christianity's inauguration. Bill?
Even though we're all Gentiles, didn't God tell us in the New Testament that we're also a peculiar people set aside from the world?
Exactly. But not by dietary laws. We're a peculiar people. We're set aside. But it hasn't got anything to do with dietary anymore. I forgot that, you know, I had this needs no answer, but I did have the quote, and I want to read it to you now. The dietary laws are abolished by the church because with the arrival of Christianity, Judaism was universalized to embrace all mankind. Israel was no longer regarded as the unique covenant people. When Christianity broke down the wall of separation between Jews and Gentiles, it naturally had to abolish that which symbolized this separation, the dietary laws. The question, suppose I'd paraphrase or read this to you this way. When Christianity broke down the wall of separation between Jews and Gentiles, it naturally meant that now what had been a sin isn't a sin anymore. I didn't say that. If it's inherently evil, then God would have never permitted it for the Gentiles, and he isn't going to now permit it for Christians. There is no darkness in him. So what I've been struggling with, and I hope this is helpful for you to think about, you know, ruminate on it. You know, chew on that for a while and see if that won't make sense. You know, that the reason we have dietary laws has not got anything to do with the nature of an evil thing in and of itself. Now, somebody else, one more hand, and I need to get into chapter 11. Bill?
When, in the early Christian era, when people were being, well, before the day of Pentecost, when people were following Christ, and the Jews had left the Jewish religion and followed Christ and eaten these foods all right.
If I'm understanding what you're saying, my sense of it is absolutely not. No Jew who becomes a disciple of Christ, a follower, a learner, goes and listens to his sermons, hears and believes what he says, is freed by that to disobey Moses' law. Why? Because there isn't any replacement yet. They are Jews. What is the law they're under? What did Jesus teach in the Sermon on the Mount? If you bring a sacrifice to the altar and remember you got a problem with your brother, what are you supposed to do? No, you're supposed to say, well, hey, I'm your disciple, Jesus, so I don't have to do these sacrifices anymore. No, that's a very wrong response, isn't it? The response is, you leave your gift, fix your problem with your brother, which, by the way, in the Sermon on the Mount, you can also read about in the Old Law. He just taught what Moses taught. Resolve that problem with your brother, and then what? Go offer your sacrifice. No Jew could stop keeping the Old Law until God terminates the Old Law. And he isn't going to do that until we have the death, burial, resurrection of Jesus, and establishment of a new kingdom. Now, everybody, come to Leviticus 11. We've got 15 minutes in an unusually long chapter. But that's just fine. It's pretty easy to outline this chapter, too. And it's only the same point that gets made over and over and over again. So, just, you know, I'm always suggesting ways to mark your Bible and, you know, make it easier and everything. This is what I did in my Bible. See that? I've got this green section. These are foods you can eat or animals you can eat. So, you know, I highlighted in green what was okay. And then I used orange for any part that says this is forbidden. So then I went through and I took a pencil and I drew a rectangle or a square around each of the things that's being talked about. So here's what I mean. In 11 verses 1 and 2, the Lord spoke again to Moses and to Aaron, saying to them, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, these are the creatures which you may eat from all the animals that are on the earth. So I drew a square long rectangle around the phrase, animals that are on the earth. This is our topic. And you can eat them. So in green I've got, these are the creatures which you may eat. And all of verse 3 I highlighted in green also. Whatever divides a hoof, thus making split hoofs, and choose the cud, so it's a ruminant, among the animals, that you may eat. Okay. Verse 4 through 8 then has a number of animals listed which are forbidden. These are unclean. They still are animals that are on the earth, but having stipulated which ones are okay, he now stipulates which ones are not. So in verse 4, you're not to eat of these among those which chew the cud or among those which divide the hoof. The camel. So a highlighted camel in orange. Though it chews cud, it does not divide the hoof. It is unclean to you. Unclean does not mean that it's inherently evil. Does not also mean that it's inherently unhealthy to eat it. All these ideas, brethren, I don't think bear out when you read Leviticus 20 and Deuteronomy like we did earlier. So he is arbitrarily, if you're not too squeamish with that word, a sovereign God who says, I'm making up some temporary laws about the fourth chocolate chip cookie. And then later I'll take it away because these things are in themselves totally neutral. But for 1,500 years, I, God, will allow certain things and not other things. And then I'm going to sweep all the dietary laws away because they're not a part of darkness. They are of the light. I'm just temporarily designating certain requirements. So then you got in verse 5, the rock badger is unclean. In verse 6, the rabbit is unclean. And in verse 7, here it is, the most famous one, the pig. For though it divides the hoof, thus making a split hoof, it does not chew cud. It is unclean. And I think now, it's, you know, these kind of things that rattle around in my head till finally they find, you know, a place where they fit. They are unclean what? What are the last two words of verse 7? To you. Are they inherently unclean? Are they unclean in and of themselves? If they are inherently unclean, then can God say, okay, you can do it for a while, and then you can't do it for a while, and then you can do it again? I don't think so. They're inherently neutral. They're inherently, nothing that goes into you can defile you. It just goes into your stomach and gets eliminated. But for 1,500 years for the Jews, it could, because God made a sovereign decision to set them apart as holy to be the light to the world. Verse 9, I highlight in green, and I put my rectangle and pencil around in the water. In 9, these you may eat, whatever's in the water, all that have fins and scales, those in the water, in the seas, or in the rivers, you may eat. That's all green. 10 through 20 is all about things you can't eat, and it's going to introduce a new category. So first, in 10 through 12, whatever's in the seas and in the rivers that do not have fins and scales among all the teeming life of the water and among all the living creatures that are in the water, they are detestable things to you. They shall be abhorrent to you. You may not eat of their flesh, and their carcasses you shall detest. Whatever's in the water that does not have fins and scales is abhorrent. What are the last two words? To you, not to the Gentiles, and not to me. When I was a kid, and we spent 2 weeks every year in the Colorado River fishing for two kinds of fish. What were they? In Colorado River, and Lake Havasu in particular. Bass and catfish. I miss my catfish. That's good stuff. But inherently immoral. It's a sin, right? It's a part of God's darkness to eat a catfish, right? Permanently, always. It's part of his character. Well, no. Gentiles were still eating catfish, and Jews were probably wishing they could. And then after Christianity comes, can you eat catfish? Well, but it doesn't have scales. And you would say, so what? Because inherently, it's just neutral. God set it apart for a while. And so it wasn't unclean, and it was unclean for certain people to you, and now it is clean again. Okay, so now we introduce a new category at verses 13 through 20. It doesn't give you what you may eat, it just gives you what you may not. And so it says, moreover, you shall detest among the birds. So in this case, the list of what you can't do is given. The list of what you could eat among the birds is not given. So square, you know, around birds. And then here's the list. In verse 13, the eagle, the vulture, and the buzzard. In verse 14, the kite and the falcon. In verse 15, the raven. In verse 16, the ostrich, the owl, the seagull, and the hawk. In 17, the little owl, the cormorant, and the great owl. In 18, the white owl, the pelican, and the carrion vulture. And in 19, the stork, the heron, and the hoopoe, and the bat. Now, I know how you love your bats. It's okay. Keep eating them. But the Jews couldn't for a while. Then we have a new category. And that new category is winged insects. And in this case, unlike previously, instead of starting with what you may eat, he starts with what you may not. All the winged insects that walk on all fours in verse 20 are detestable. What are the last two words? You. Not to everybody, not inherently, but for you guys. Now in 21, yet those you may eat among all the winged insects which walk on all fours, these which have above their feet jointed legs with which to jump on the earth. Those of them you may eat. The locust. What law was John the Baptist under? Lived and died. Moses' law. What's he eating out in the wilderness? A winged insect. But was it clean or unclean? It was in the list at verse 22. And the devastating locust and the cricket and the grasshopper. So they're a winged insect, but they got the jointed legs. They can jump. So you can eat those to your heart's content. Anybody here ever eaten a locust, a cricket, or a grasshopper? There you go. There's two right there. Now, isn't that just disgusting? We should kick them out of the church. It's an inherently evil thing. No. Well, it's inherently good. I don't think that either, really. It's just neutral. It's just a winged insect. Okay? But good for you. Now, go ahead. Tell us it tastes like chicken, right? Okay, whatever. All right, so now in 23, you get your winged insects some more down through verse 26. So 23 through 26 is prohibited winged insects. Four-footed are detestable. By these, moreover, you'll be made unclean. Whoever touches their carcasses, so it's not just eating them. If you touch their carcass, you're unclean until evening. Whoever picks up any of their carcasses shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. And here's another one. Concerning all the animals which divide the hoof but do not make a split hoof, of which do not chew cud, they're unclean to you. Whoever touches them becomes unclean. Well, we had that group before, but we were talking about eating them. Now what is additionally unclean? And clearly it hasn't got anything to do with God's insight into what will cause you to live longer. You can't even touch it. Now, 27. Also, here's a new category, what walks on its paws. Now, I know, that's the end of your koala bears, but you can't. Among all the creatures that walks on all fours are unclean to you. Whoever touches their carcasses becomes unclean to evening. The one who picks up their carcasses shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. They're unclean for you. 29. New category. These are to you the unclean among the what? Swarming things. Now, I never thought of moles as being a swarming thing, so I'm not sure about the definition. Mice are a swarming thing, and great lizard, whatever that was, is a swarming thing. And particularly with a gecko, I've seen enough commercials to know that they don't swarm by my definition. But nonetheless, they're called that. So again, in some cases, I don't even understand, how do crocodiles swarm? The lizard, the sand reptile, and the chameleon. I think the only time I've ever seen two chameleons is when they're in the same aquarium. So, brethren, as I pointed out many times before, there are major elements of the old law that could not possibly be practiced today, because even though we have a written record about these things, we would not be able to recreate the laws concerning those things, because today we don't have what? We don't have the inspired builders of the temple furniture or the inspired explainers of certain activities. You'll notice that in your Old Testament, both how things were built for that temple service and then how things were to take place in that temple service without the original people and the verbal passing down of how to build these things today, what's in the text, there's not enough to know. And likewise with these animals. We're not even sure what some of these animals are. How would you keep these dietary restrictions today if we don't even know what the animal is? What's a hoopoe? So I don't know why it's called a swarming thing, but it was. God had that designation then. And so lay off the crocodiles. 31. These are to you the unclean among all the swarming things. Whoever touches them when they're dead becomes unclean until evening. And then he starts in on 32 through 35 with additional ideas that do not involve now either the eating of the animal or even the touching of the animal. Anything which one of them may fall when they're dead becomes unclean. Wooden articles, clothing, skin, sack, put in the water, unclean until evening, earthenware vessels, food. So you get these requirements. So once again, brethren, that's because God is arbitrarily to them and not the Gentiles, establishing distinctions that will not have been true before this time and will be true for all time after the Jewish law. Notice in 36, a spring or a cistern collecting water shall be clean, even though the one who touches their carcass shall be unclean. So if one of these animals falls into your well, do you have to go without water from then on? Somebody's going to have to fish the body out, but can you still drink the water? Sure, a whole village could perish if you didn't allow that. So here are these, distinctions, and we're not going to read the rest of them. In verse 38 through 43, all these things are forbidden, but you get the point. Now, 43. I just wanted to finish, and we're right on time, this is exactly what I wanted to accomplish here, is these last three verses, four verses, 44 through 47. Now, I highlighted all this in yellow. I chose a different color because it had a different flavor to this discussion, verses 44 through 47. This is important. Now, watch this again. 44. I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be what? Holy, which means what? Separate. From whom? The Gentiles. You shall not make yourselves unclean with any of the swarming things that swarm on the earth. For I am the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt to be your God. Thus you shall be holy. For I am holy. This is the law regarding the animal and the bird and every living thing that moves in the waters and everything that swarms on the earth. So now we get a summary statement. To make a distinction between the sinful and the not sinful, between the healthy or the unhealthy. No, between the clean and the unclean. And between the edible creature and the creature which is not to be eaten. Now I'm going to add it, but he did many times in the chapter to begin with. To you, and for what? Because it's not inherently a dark thing, it's a neutral thing, but I, God, also recognize that you Jews are not inherently evil or inherently good. I did not pick you, he will tell them in other places, because you're so much better than the Gentiles. Because you're more handsome and pretty. Because you're smarter than the Gentiles. What is the point God made? Jews and Gentiles are both equally what? People. That's all they are. There's nothing inherently holy or unholy about those people. But for a while, what did God do with the Jews? He called them holy. And all Gentiles, evil, sinful, wicked, mean, nasty. No, just separate. Because I'm using the Jews to be the light of the world. I'm making a point with them. Hopefully that'll help. If not, the elders will fire me this evening. We'll go from there. If you have questions about it, please, by all means, give me a call, or we can talk about it anytime. Thanks very much.